then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder, by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud walled cabin eyes were watching through the night, many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's March the 18th, 2010. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest.
Rising of the moon, there beside the singing river, that dark mass of men were seen, far above their shining weapons, on their own beloved green. Death to every foe and traitor, forward strike the marching tune, and hurrah, my boys, for freedom, 'tis the rising of the moon.
Okay, I think some of you were a bit bored by last week's broadcast, wherein I basically just sat down and read an article out of Northwest Observer. And so this week, I think we'll devote ourselves solely to your own questions and suggested discussion topics. Now, one thing, for various reasons this week, I haven't had enough time to write out any scripts or much in the way of talking points. And so most of this broadcast, I'm just going to have to wing. I can use the edit function on my WavePad to try and edit out a lot of the e's and er's and uh's. And the trouble with that is that I end up sounding like I gabble. But nonetheless, I think I'll give it an extemporaneous shot here and see how I do. Comrade Paul in Tacoma writes, I just received an email from the 9/11 Truth Movement telling me about the Fox News case. A journalist was fired from Fox News for objecting to telling lies on the air. Fox was found guilty by a jury of fraud, but the appeals court overruled them, stating that the press is exempt from being sued if it lies to the public. Fox News was being sued for $450,000. Lying to the public violates the policy of the FCC. Therefore, if justice is to be served, Fox News should lose their license. Yes, Paul, they should. In an ideal world, every radio or television station or network that deliberately lies to the public would lose their license, and the people responsible would be arrested and face criminal charges for fraud. Pigs may fly, too, but I ain't waiting around to see it happen. One of the first things that anyone who seriously desires to bring about any change in this society needs to learn is to disregard 90% of what they see or read in the Jewish and liberal-controlled news media. This is just a given. Of course you can't believe everything you pick up on the internet, either. Mark Twain once said, if you don't read the newspapers, you're uninformed. If you do read the newspapers, then you are misinformed. I think the modern variation would be, if you listen to the mainstream media, you will be misinformed. If you listen to the internet, you'll be overwhelmed. The internet has broken the power of the mainstream media to a large extent, but the trouble is that what's taken the mainstream media's place is this deluge of data, some of it misinformation and some of it disinformation. It just buries you with sheer quantity, and some of it's just as false and Looney Tunes as anything you'll see on Fox News or MSNBC. The 9/11 Truth Movement is a good example. By now, it's obvious that we have not been told the truth about the events of September the 11th, 2001. Hell, it was obvious a week after it happened that we weren't being told the truth. I especially like the way that those four Israelis who were arrested while they were laughing and filming all the destruction from a nearby rooftop have simply disappeared out of the picture, along with those so-called Israeli art students who were trying to get into American military bases in the week just before the attacks. Poof, like they'd never been. It's also pretty obvious that until such time arrives as some revolutionary regime, ours or some other, can force the opening of secret government archives here and in Israel, we're never going to know the truth. I simply accept the fact that we've been lied to, totally deceived, and there's nothing we can do about it. But at the same time, I think we do have a pretty good idea in a general way what happened, and then I drive on. My personal opinion on 9/11 is that it was at least 80% or so just what it appeared to be. Occam's razor, the simplest explanation, is usually the correct one. After half a century of loading up Israel with American money and American weapons and American political cover and Holocaust propaganda, I think the Muslim world got pissed off enough to finally hit us back. Now, it's entirely possible that the Israeli Mossad had prior knowledge of this and didn't warn Washington in order to bring about what eventually happened, which was American troops in the Middle East protecting Israel's kosher ass. It's entirely possible that some of the American intelligence agencies had forewarning and were too stupid, lazy, or incompetent to do anything about it. That I'm totally up for. But this more exotic stuff about remote-controlled jets and explosives inside the tower, no, that I don't buy. Guys, we have to rein in all this paranoia about CIA and other government plots. The CIA isn't competent enough to conspire on that level. No one in the federal government is. And the Israeli Mossad isn't all that competent either. Look at what an incredible cock-up they made of assassinating that Hamas man in Dubai a few months ago. It took 17 of them just to strangle one Arab in a hotel room, and they still got caught out. The Twin Towers collapsed because they were built by American capitalism and unionized labor, both of whom are notoriously inept. In the city of New York, which is notoriously corrupt, and where the whole construction industry is mobbed up to the gills. And so they did shoddy work that collapsed at the first touch of a jumbo jet. I think it's that simple. Nonetheless, I admit I haven't really bothered to make a full study of the whole 9/11 thing myself, because I don't need to. As soon as I saw what the Washington, D.C. regime was doing with the event, the kind of unconstitutional laws they were passing, the revocation of civil liberties, indefinite detention without trial, warrantless wiretaps, legalized torture, and all those post-9/11 goodies, I just assumed that the whole thing was a setup. Clinton tried to do the same thing back in 1995 after Oklahoma City. Now, there's a case I do have a certain amount of expertise on, if I may digress a moment. Now, there was a genuine mystery. As most of you are aware, I believe I know at least part of the secret of Oklahoma City. I am, however, under a 13-year-old court injunction which effectively orders me not to publish anything about Oklahoma City, which does not conform to the officially sanctioned parameters of speculation on the subject, including the identity of the mysterious John Doe No. 2. I can, however, assure you that we never got the full story there. But one thing I have learned over the years, Paul, and that is that if we allow ourselves to become bogged down in the details of every one of these sordid little government conspiracies, if we get to the point where we are obsessed with proving some little point of fact or other to the exclusion of all else, then we'll all go just as nuts as the liberals and the regime claim that we are already. It's enough for me to understand that the world is wrong and that the society in which we live is irredeemably evil. And that if there is to be any hope at all for humanity at large, never mind our own race, then things must change. That's all I need to know. I don't sweat the details. I know a lot of people still cling to the old adage about ye shall know the truth and the truth shall make you free, but the trouble is it doesn't. We have known the truth for decades now, and we're less free than ever before. Mere knowledge of the truth isn't enough. The beasts who rule us don't particularly care what we know, so long as they can rest assured that we will never do anything about it. The only way things will ever change is if we act on our knowledge. Now, an email from James, another one of our comrades in Tacoma. Dear Harold, I'm catching up on your radio programs this week. Here are some suggested topics for discussion. Number one, how to become more self-reliant, food, utilities, barter and trade, etc. Number two, self-employment versus working for the man. Number three, getting involved in local politics, commissions, elected positions, going to city council meetings, so forth and so on. Okay, James, I think the first two topics are connected. The first way to become more self-reliant, of course, is to quit relying on others. You should reassess your personal needs and those of your family and get a lot of things out of your life that you don't really need to be there. Most of us could benefit from dumping everything from the horrible American diet to toys like boats and ATVs to television itself. Why the hell do you need a boat, which you have to pay property taxes on, while it just sits in your driveway for all but 3 weekends out of the year? If you want to go fishing, rent one and give a white sailor a job. Why do you need to go running around in the woods playing grab-ass on a motorbike or an ATV and frightening the wildlife? Why do you need television? Turn the damn thing off, disconnect it, save the cable bill, and go take out a library card. The capitalist system and the consumer society teach white people from birth that they absolutely must have a lot of things that actually they don't need at all. That's one of the ways that politically correct society keeps us under control. Like drug pushers giving out free samples, the Jews get us hooked on all these pointless luxuries, and then they supply us with those luxuries at a price. The price of our souls. A lot of the things that Americans really do need and use every day can actually be obtained far more cheaply than they usually are. I, myself, am an expert in how to live cheaply. I have no choice. I get my shoes from Walmart and my clothes from Goodwill. That means I look like a bum most of the time, but so what? Who am I supposed to be impressing? Okay, maybe you don't want to go quite that far, although I'm not sure exactly why you have to buy your clothes at Galleria or Nordstrom's or some big fancy shop in a mall when you can get perfectly serviceable versions of the same thing at half the cost at Walmart and Costco. And how about food? Don't load up on all that processed crap in the supermarket and all that microwave stuff. Get the basics. Bread and meat and fruits and vegetables and learn how to cook. A lot of Americans, including entirely too many American women, don't even remember what the inside of a kitchen looks like. You will find that not only are you healthier, but your grocery bill drops significantly. I guess that's one lesson Americans need to learn in order to be more self-reliant. Quit being a consumer snob. We don't need $300 running shoes and spandex outfits to go running in, wear old clothes and one of a dozen less expensive kinds of footwear. Why do we actually need a new Lexus when a 3-year-old used Toyota Tercel will do just as nicely as far as getting you from point A to point B? Why do we need a huge monster pickup truck? I used to see these 21-year-old computer kids at the company in Texas where I worked drive into the parking lot with these huge Godzilla trucks that they were making $400 a month payment on, and for what? Are you actually working on a farm or running a construction contracting business for which you really do need a truck? If so, try Toyota or Ford. If not, then buy yourself a good used car. The point in owning an automobile is to get yourself from point A to point B, not to make up for the inadequacy of your male biological equipment by driving something the size of a tank that gets 1 mile for every 3 gallons. Now, as far as self-employment goes, yeah, that's the way to go if you can swing it. These days, American capitalist society seems to be designed so you can't. Indeed, that's one of the main differences between free enterprise and capitalism. Free enterprise encourages self-employment and genuine entrepreneurialism. Capitalism is a form of serfdom where, instead of being tied to the plow on a medieval manor, people are tied to their cubicles in some air-conditioned glass and steel dungeon. Limbaugh and Glenn Beck and the neocons have a point here. If you're self-employed, it's almost impossible to run your business and make a living, never mind make a profit, without tripping over your own shoelaces due to all the government regulations you have to comply with and all the forms you have to fill out. And God help you if you actually attempt to hire somebody. Then you get into the wonderful world of state and federal withholding tax, providing medical insurance for your employees, Social Security, Medicare, liability insurance, OSHA. The list goes on and on. You see, capitalism doesn't really like free enterprise. Capitalism wants everybody working for a major multinational corporation and drawing a paycheck, not using their own skills and tools and work ethic to support himself. Capitalism wants everyone dependent on the system for their livelihood, just like Marxist socialism wants everybody dependent on the state for everything. Both capitalism and communism are two sides of the same Jewish coin. They both want you to be dependent on them for everything you have. And of course, that will make everyone a lot less prone to rock the boat or ask unpleasant questions, or to protest when the time comes to give white Americans the shaft. In America, under the First Amendment, everyone supposedly has the right to freedom of speech, freedom of expression, freedom of conscience, and to exercise these rights without retaliation. Dream on, my friend, dream on. The courts have already ruled on numerous occasions that these restrictions apply only to the government, and that it's more or less okay for private employers to discriminate or retaliate against their employees for dissident thought or activity. I don't know of a single case where a white male has successfully sued for reinstatement or even gotten any financial compensation after being fired or demoted for making a politically incorrect remark or for participation in any kind of politically incorrect activity of the kind that's supposed to be constitutionally protected. That's probably the single factor that keeps white people in line more than anything else, the very realistic fear that if they step out of line on anything racial, or refuse to contribute to the AIDS walkathon, or fail to promote diversity in the workplace, whatever the hell that means, they'll lose their jobs and be blacklisted for making a living. So, yes, James, self-employment is great if you can pull it off. If nothing else, it means that the boss can't fire you for thinking politically incorrect thoughts. It's like the advice I give young white boys when they ask me what they should do with their lives, and some of them do, believe it or not. I advise them to learn a trade, to get a marketable skill, to learn to fix the rich man's toys, his car or his computer or his air conditioning, and learn to do it so well and so inexpensively that no one will care what your political and racial views are. Now, as far as getting involved in local politics, I say by all means. There's a saying that all politics is local, and so will ours be eventually. We need to think racially, but act locally. By all means, start attending city council meetings or county commission or zoning commissions or whatever is applicable to your situation. If nothing else, it will keep our people off the computer and out from in front of the television and accustom them to functioning in the real world, which is something we're badly in need of. One day, you will need all the local political knowledge you can accumulate on who said what and did what and where all the local bodies are buried. Sometimes that means literally. This will be the sea in which you have to swim one day. Okay, time for our first music break. Something nice and mellow, I think. This is some Irish tenor I never heard of, singing a song that I quoted in one chapter of my novel, The Stars in Their Path. It's called She Moved Through the Fair.
My young love said to me, my mother won't mind, and my father won't slight you for your lack of kind. She stepped away from me, and this she did say, it will not be long, love, till our wedding stepped away from me, and she moved through the fair, and fondly I watched her move here and move there. She went her way homewards with one star awake, as the swan came to me, my young love came in. So softly she entered that her feet made no din. She came close beside me, and this she did say, it will not be long, love, till our wedding day.
Okay, next question up from our own Colonel House. I'd like to hear about some of the mid-range plans for the Northwest Front after the propaganda war and the recruiting effort to produce good results. When Zog experiences some future disaster, making it impossible to dispatch legions of mercenaries to shoot us down like dogs, what function can the NF perform in the areas of government, media, industry, food production, etc.? I need some inspiration. Well, don't we all? I'm somewhat hampered when I deal with topics like this due to my lack of a crystal ball. We don't know exactly what is going to happen over the next few years, although more and more, as the Obama depression continues, and as Obongo himself provides more clues, we can start making a few prognostications. For example, you may have noticed in the news over the past couple of weeks that already, even before they've rammed Obamacare through, which should happen in the next week or so, the Democrats are already talking up the next big item on their agenda, so-called immigration reform, which basically means amnestying and legalizing the estimated 20 to 30 million illegal aliens in this country, almost all of them from third world countries, especially Beaners. Now, this is a linchpin of liberal policy. They want all those Latinos and other mud people legalized and on the electoral rolls and voting, so as to ensure perpetual power for the Democratic Party. Under our system, which includes the Electoral College and a House of Representatives based on population, this will mean that from then on, elections will be hopelessly weighted in favor of about 8 states, which include the most minorities, these being California, New York, Texas, Florida, Illinois, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, and certain states in the South that are rapidly filling up with blacks and browns, like North Carolina and Georgia. The media usually refers to these as so-called battleground states, and what it all means is that effectively, whites will henceforth be permanently outvoted, even though we're still technically a majority of the U.S. population. After amnesty, when all those non-white Democratic votes come rolling in, the Democrats will have a permanent control over the presidency and the entire executive branch, including command of the American military, and also the House of Representatives. That's when they'll move on to the third leg of their tripod of perpetual power, gun control and gun confiscation, to deprive white Americans of their last possible avenue of resistance to their racial marginalization and eventually their racial destruction. Now, assuming that the Northwest Front can get our act together while all this is going on, which is still a pretty big assumption, our task during this period will have several major objectives. We must make millions of our white brothers and sisters aware of the fact that we are here, and they must have at least some idea of what we stand for, i.e. a sovereign white homeland here in the Pacific Northwest. The idea of white separatism in a land of our own here on the North American continent has to be presented to our people in a simple and understandable way, and the idea of migration has to be pushed to the max. Whites as a whole must be convinced that the old United States is gone forever, that there will be no return to the days of the Brady Bunch, and that their only hope is to do like the Welsh and the Afrikaners and other white nations in the past have done. They must flee to an area pre-selected as viable for our purpose and prepare to make a fight for freedom there. This also, of course, means convincing them that there is no longer any realistic hope to take back the entire United States from the scum that have taken it over, and that's going to be a pretty tall PR order. Secondly, the Northwest Front will have to convince people living here in the homeland of pretty much the same thing. We'll have to begin the creation of a separate sense of nationhood. Now, this has already been done once in living memory with the Jews in the State of Israel, although admittedly that isn't an especially savory example. But it can be done, especially if, as I suspect, the United States government has 51 other different problems on their plate and they won't be able to devote their full strength towards suppressing the new nationalist movement in the Northwest. Always bear in mind that even at the height of our coming revolutionary struggle, the Americans will have all kinds of other issues to worry about, including a basket case economy and at least 2 pointless and endless foreign wars that will be draining American resources like gigantic leeches, maybe 3 if Obongo's Jewish handlers like Rahm Emanuel and David Axelrod decide to attack Iran. So, as daunting as our task is, if we will approach it seriously and intelligently, we can do this. Now, on the ground, yes, I think the NF should engage in community support work as much as we possibly can, although that'll require a supply of money and personnel that's going to be a long time coming. This is how organizations like Hamas and Hezbollah maintain their moral authority in places like Gaza and Lebanon and the West Bank. They provide economic and medical and social services, such as jobs and clinics and schools, that neither the Israelis nor the completely corrupt and sold-out Fatah government will provide. If the party can be seen to come through for white people when no one else will, if white people in the Northwest know that they can turn to the Northwest Front for help that the American authorities and the corrupt state and local bureaucracies infested with liberals and minorities refuse to provide, then that will be the crucial battle for the hearts and minds of the people won, and that is a battle that we must win. We are not yet in a position to provide that help yet. We had a very sad example this summer when we lost someone who had excellent potential because we simply were not in a position to provide him with a place to stay, not even a mattress on the floor or a can of beans. We have to change that, but I can't do it without your help, and that's something I will be talking about to you folks more privately in the coming weeks and months. Things like this are also highly important for the party because they'll help us build an infrastructure that will allow us actually to govern once independence is finally achieved. I've tried to make this point in a number of places in the Northwest novels. It's not just enough to drive the Zionists and the liberals and the corrupt politicians and the minorities out. Once they're gone, then what the hell do we do? And we need to start thinking about this. We have to provide proof of our pudding in the form of taking over and maintaining a civilized and technological Western society, which the United States can no longer do. As part of our propaganda and outreach efforts into the white community, we will have to prove to our own people that we do have a vision and a plan for a better world to come. This is why we needed things like the constitutional exercise of 2006, wherein we created the draft constitution of the Northwest American Republic, which, by the way, can be seen on our website at northwestfront.org. We had to demonstrate that we are not just mindless haters as we're portrayed in the enemy media. We had to show that we are, in fact, a real and possible alternative to the horror which is now life in Obama's America. Okay, music break time again. Believe it or not, I actually do have a growing number of fans for the Northwest novels out there, and some of them even have their favorite characters. Last week, I played a piece by Steve Earle that I described as Shane Ryan's theme from A Distant Thunder, and I immediately got a few emails from Rooney Wingfield fans, whom I was surprised to learn existed at all, but apparently some do. They asked me if Shane has his own theme music, what was Rooney's theme song? Well, actually, lady, she didn't have one, at least not one that I played on my Walkman while I was writing the book, like Shane and some of the others did. Now, Nightshade in A Mighty Fortress actually had a kind of a theme song, but I can't find that anywhere on the net. Anyway, I envisioned Rooney as one of the last of her kind, a good old-fashioned redneck woman, but young enough to actually be of some use during a revolution. Definitely not a Tea Party lady. Surely there must be some of those left out there somewhere, although I'm damned if I can find them. Anyway, if I had to pick a theme for Rooney, it would probably go something like this. This is Nobody's Darling.
Take my love, take by me.
The next email is from Comrade Felix Alfarth. Dear HAC, I was thinking of a topic for RFN, something along the lines of meeting people in the Northwest, which you've written about several times, that initial contact procedure, and like you said, the restaurant test. My wife was wanting something on the topic of more families meeting up. Many people are just too damn paranoid and need to be set at ease. Okay, I need to get into this because it's one of those topics that requires spaced repetition. First, let's go over the basic initial contact protocol for the Northwest Front. The first step I need from someone who wanders in off the internet is a name and a postal mailing address. The address can be a post office box or a PMB number, that's fine. Just some place where the post office will deliver mail. The name needs to be a full name, not just Joe or Veronica or an acronym from some little Hollywood Nazi group with all the three members, two of whom probably don't even know their members. In the first place, the post office usually will not deliver mail without a full name. In the second place, these priority mail packets are expensive, and every time one is returned marked undeliverable as addressed, we are out almost $10. In the third place, the refusal to supply a full name shows me somebody's trying to jack us around from the get-go. And most likely this is just what we call an ICI, an idle curiosity inquiry to try and get some free stuff, which is a very common attitude in the movement. Remember, the NF is the real thing. Paranoia has to stop and trust has to start somewhere, and it starts with you. If you don't trust us, then we don't trust you. Your intro packet will include a copy of the 3rd edition Northwest Migration Manual, otherwise known as the White Book. This manual is not simply thrown in to add weight to the envelope. It is the most important item in the intro pack. Read it carefully and study it. It contains the answers you claim to be seeking. I don't want this book scanned and placed on the internet, and so far, to the best of my knowledge, my wishes have been respected. Anyone who does so, in spite of my stipulation that this not be done, demonstrates to me that he's a dick who is incapable of following simple instructions as well as incapable of rudimentary courtesy, i.e. he's somebody we don't need in the party. The next step after receipt of an individual packet is internet or snail mail correspondence. Now, during this period, you will be looked over first off for basic compos mentis, and after that for intelligence, communication skills, presentation, general personality, and cop-on. And then comes chat rooms, then phone calls, most likely by Skype. You will need to give me or the unit leader in your area a short introduction and biography. Anything you say can and will be used for an actual background check, which is unique in the movement. And I don't just mean Googling somebody's name. So far as I know, we are the only group around that actually bothers to check people out. In view of who we are and what we envision for the future, it's entirely logical and reasonable for me and other NF people to want to know who the hell we're talking to when we sit down together. A photograph of yourself and your wife, husband, or significant other will be helpful, as well as any children. Suffice it to say, we have, on rare occasions, turned up some unpleasant surprises along that line. Now, I considered flat-out asking for social security numbers, but I recognized that there would be legitimate concerns with that. While I don't know you, neither do you know me, and considering all the crap and the goat dancing on the internet about me, a request for a social security number would probably fuel the goat dance even more and make it worse. Besides, if someone really is a federal cop or an SPLC spy of some kind, that could easily be faked. This system is crude and imperfect, and the FBI or whoever could dummy up a fake background easily, but I intend to force them to do just that. These people are getting paid taxpayer money to violate the Constitution, and I mean to make them work for it. I mean to make them cover all the bases, dot their I's, and cross their T's. Never make anything easier for these people who are spying on us and who seek to do us harm. Our present vetting system isn't perfect, not at all, and like I said, it could easily be circumvented by anyone who is seriously trying to get close to us in order to do harm. We're doing it for two reasons. A, to get ourselves used to the concept of doing things correctly and competently as revolutionaries, which is something that white Americans have no previous experience in. And B, we want to weed out movement kooks and dysfunctionals of the kind that the late Pam Emmerich described to me as not cops, not kikes, not spies, just trouble. I'm specifically looking for past movement background. Obviously, we can't and we won't disqualify everyone who's ever taken part in other groups' activities just for that reason. But I need to have a general idea of who you've been hanging with on the internet and otherwise, because I need to know what kind of movement, contaminants, and toxicities you may have picked up. Yes, this is important. I need to know what baggage you're bringing with you into the Northwest Front. Then comes actual meeting. The first meeting should be a one-on-one with myself or some other senior person whom I trust to make the evaluation. The idea here is to put a face to the email address to make sure that you really exist, that you really are white, and that you're not really the holy rabbi Hyman Hebelbaum from the Temple Schmuck L jacking us around on the internet. Crap like that's happened before, although not to me and not to the NF. I want someone who has been met individually and checked for all the basics, i.e. white skin, no obvious Negroid or Asiatic racial characteristics, no grossly Semitic face, sound mind, not falling down drunk or high, no body odor or tics or obvious indications of instability, so forth and so on. Only then do you get invited to a larger meeting and get to meet some of the others. Now, the basic rule is no strangers walk through the door. At least that's the rule insofar as we can enforce it. Now, bear in mind that these few simple protocols are the result of many years of bitter experience, including many years of prison time for some of us. These rules are for your protection just as much as ours. Now, the restaurant test that Comrade Felix refers to is something I myself came up with. You take somebody to a restaurant in order to observe what kind of common sense they've got, or lack of it. Does this new person have sense enough to understand that racially conscious whites are a persecuted minority? That we have no rights, and like all persecuted minorities, we must therefore keep our voices down in public? Does he show up wearing some kind of extreme white power t-shirt, go into a restaurant and start shouting racial slurs at the top of his lungs and generally showing his butt, starting fights that you have to finish? I've had that happen before. We need people who are intelligent and dedicated and loyal and willing to sacrifice for the Republic. But above all, they have to have a generous helping of pure common sense in their makeup. The restaurant test is for common sense. As for families getting together, the first thing we need is actual families to get together. I'm sorry to say that as yet the movement demographic includes far too few of those. Like all revolutionary movements, we naturally tend to attract most of our people from the demographic that suffers the most under the existing regime, which in our case usually means white males, all too often middle-aged white males. This has to change. Obama and his Jews are out for all of our blood, not just middle-aged white men. And somehow we have to make our women and our youth understand this. It's very hard when only a small handful of people even know we're here. But letting people know we're here is you guys' department, not mine. There's another problem. When white family people do become involved, in many cases, one spouse, usually the wife, is, shall we say, non-supportive. Sometimes she's simply jealous of the time her husband is putting into his racial activity, which she sees as an annoying hobby at best. But more usually, it's because she's afraid that her husband's participation will endanger the family home and income, and in all honesty, I can't very well tell such wives that this isn't a possibility. All I can tell them is that the perpetuation of the present system is far more of a long-term threat to their home and family than anything the NF might do, and in this age of Obama, I think more and more white women are starting to get a glimmer of that. I know it's very hard for racially aware white families with young children who are desperately looking for other such families so that their kids can have somebody to play with. I admit, in one way, I'm glad my children grew up in Ireland when it was still comparatively white. If I had had to try and raise children here in the middle of this American cesspool in a public school, because no way could I ever have afforded private schooling, I probably would have ended up doing something I most likely shouldn't describe on the air, given the paranoid and vicious nature of some of the people with power who are listening to this. Nothing can so corrupt white children as hanging out with Muggle kids, going over to their houses and watching television and MTV and porno websites and all the filthy corruption of political correctness. White children need other white children. They can't grow up just around adults because that makes them isolated and weird. The solution is one that I have propounded again and again and again, and that is that we must learn to live in communities. Large numbers of us living within half an hour's drive of each other. Not hiding behind personal computers scattered all over this huge continent from Washington to Texas to Connecticut to Michigan and back to California. There is your solution to at least 50% of what ails us. Socially, economically, politically, there are still tens of thousands of us out there, and not all of us are old coots or middle-aged men with big bellies. There are white families involved. There are white children who could play with your kids. Who knows, maybe there's even a few single, inaccessible white females of childbearing age out there in internet land. Many of you hearing my voice right now are among the people we need to come home here to the Pacific Northwest, to the land that divine will has appointed for our race's final destiny. Why don't you do it? I have to admit, I still don't get that. Every persecuted minority in the world has survived by banding together in support, except for us. We seem to be more afraid of human contact with our own people than of hiding all alone in some little trailer or apartment surrounded by enemies. Whatever this weird psychological bug in our makeup is, I wish to hell I could find some way to get around it. Folks, I'm going to have to cut this off now because, believe it or not, I am actually busy today and I need to get this done, get it edited, get it up on the website, and then get going on other projects, and that's a good thing. That much hope I can offer you. Things are in fact looking up for the Northwest Front, in the sense that there is now serious work for me and others to do, and we now have to budget our time in a way we never did before, not even a year ago. These podcasts really seem to have helped. Slowly, slowly, ever so slowly, but surely, the word about Northwest independence and a sovereign white nation of our own, the word about the Northwest novels, and the word about the Northwest Front is starting to percolate throughout the movement, and from there it will begin to seep into the white racial community as a whole. Always remember that we are, in fact, making progress. Not enough progress, too slow, but progress nonetheless. One day, it really all will come together. And one day we will win this thing and we will secure the existence of our people and the future for white children. Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Anandban. Freedom.